Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Pat Craig, theater critic for the Bay Area News Group, and I will be moderating tonight's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Brian Copeland, KGO radio talk show host, acclaimed comedian, actor, author, and playwright, most notably of Not a Genuine Black Man, one of the longest running, I think the longest running, one-man shows in San Francisco. And I've known Brian for a long time, since he was a genuine black kid, as a matter of fact. I think he was 13 or so. And I got a call at the newspaper I was working for in Hayward. And this man named Brian called me up about promoting a comic book show and wanted to talk about it. And I said, okay, well, I'll come out and we can talk a little bit. And so I came out and this kid answers the door. And so I'm here to see Brian Copeland. And he said, yeah, that's you? So anyway, he kind of took off from there and really had a wonderful, wonderful time immersing himself in show business.
Brian, like a eulogy. Why does it sound like a eulogy?
now that Brian's 21.
We're going to miss him very much.
We'll miss him a lot. Now, talk a little bit about some of the things you did as a kid, because it's some amazing stuff.
Oh, well, just the thing that we were talking about here is I've been a comic book collector since I was a kid, and I used to go to comic book conventions, and I still do when I have a chance. And I came up with this idea, why don't I try to do one myself? So I rented out this hall, Centennial Hall at Hayward, and I charged people $50 a table to sell comic books and $3 a head to come in and buy them. And, and what happened to the money I made, I have no idea. But what was really cool about it was after the first one went really well, I thought, let me try to see if I can get some guests to come. And I think the one that you actually came and covered was, at the time, Channel 44 was running Blondie. Yes. Every Sunday morning. And I loved it with Penny Singleton and Arthur Lake. Mm-hmm. And so I tracked down Arthur Lake. He was an old man, maybe 85, 86 years old. And he was amazed that this, you know, little kid knows who he is. And I asked him if he'd come and be a guest. And he came out to be a guest and taught me how to go, Blondie! I used to write. We were talking backstage, telling show business stories. I started out writing for a weekly paper in San Leandro when I was 12. I had my first column. I had 200 words a week to write whatever it was I wanted to write, and I used that as an excuse to meet people from old TV shows who I liked. And so I met Jack Kelly from Maverick, who taught me how to play poker. I got to meet Adam West from Batman, Arthur Lake, and folks like that. So I've been. I was always called precocious.
I think that's a good word for it. I certainly saw you as precocious.
I was precocious. I mean, yeah. Realize you were right about me my whole life.
Yeah, that's right.
Pretty much when I was doing comic conventions, you were writing for the review, and then when I got into television, you were the TV critic by then and wrote about me. And then when I got into theater, you were the theater critic.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. What are you going to do next? I'd like to find out what I'm going to do next.
I was going to say, I think you should write about Fortune 500 companies. We're multimillionaires or something. Maybe that seems to be a good...
Yeah. So how did you go from kid to bigger kid and comic? Because that was kind of the next step, wasn't it, after you did the newspaper column and those kinds of things?
Well, I had always liked stand-up. And I'll tell you, the life-changing moment for me in terms of stand-up was when I was, again, about 15, 16. And I was watching HBO one night, and I saw Richard Pryor's first concert special, live in concert, the one that he did in Long Beach, where he talked about having a heart attack. Having his heart attack and making fun of his heart attack and how, you know, he's, you know, trying to talk to God and some, you know, angel, his heart gets mad because his heart finds out that he's talking to God behind his heart's back. shooting the tires out of his car, all these things that have been in the news that year, like 77 or something, shooting the tires out of his wife's car so she can't leave him, you know, and all of these kinds of, you know, normal everyday things that happen to all of us. But it was so funny and so real, and I didn't know that comedy could be like that. You know, I'd grown up, you know, watching Alan King on The Tonight Show and these kinds of the mother-in-law jokes. I didn't know it could be that real. So I used to go to to comedy clubs in the city, to the Punchline and to Cobb's. I had a fake ID that I got in Berkeley on University Avenue for $15. Dr. Copeland said I was Dr. Copeland.
Dr. Copeland.
And they took it.
Now, how old were you when you were doing this?
15, 16, I guess. Dr. Copeland. And actually, and it's in the book. You read Not a Genuine Black Man. I tell the story in the book of being at Harvey's in Lake Tahoe and playing the dollar slot machines. And
15 years old and playing dollar machines.
I was 16. Maybe it was quarter machines. I forget what it was. But it was I was 16 or 17. And I'm playing the machines, and the security guard standing in the corner watching me. And doesn't say a word as I'm losing my butt. And then I hit. And then here he is. And he asked for my ID. And so I pull out the ID. And he looks at the ID and looks at me and looks at the ID. He goes, "Doctor, huh?" And I go, "Yeah." He goes, "You look kind of young to be a doctor." I said, "Child prodigy." And it was like a $100 jackpot. And he goes, "You got a choice. You can argue with me, and I'll call the police. And when they come find out the ID's fake, you'll go with them. Or you can leave the $100 and leave the ID here." And I said, "You have a nice day." So I would go and I'd watch comics in San Francisco. And the week after I graduated from high school, Tommy Thomas, who'd been my CYO baseball coach when I was a kid, opened up the original Tommy T's up the street from the house. And it was just starting college. I was at Holy Names in pre-law. I was going to be a lawyer. Grew up on Perry Mason, mm-hmm. and I was going to be a defense lawyer because everyone's innocent. And that was my plan. I was going to get all these poor innocent people off by exposing the real murderer and have them break down and go, "I didn't mean to kill him." And I call Tommy up one night, and I'm 18, and I say, "Do you have an amateur night?" And he goes, "No, but I got a comic sick tonight. Can you do 15 minutes?" And, you know, being 18 and stupid, I said, "Sure." And the show was at 8, and this is like at 6 o'clock. And I opened up the paper, and I think the Falklands War was going on. I wrote 15 minutes of jokes about Reagan and the Falklands War. And I came in, and I did them for about 10 or 12 people or something, and they laughed. And I was hooked. From then on, I was hooked.
That's all it takes.
And that's how it all started.
So if you'd bombed that night, who knows? You may have been a lawyer.
Yeah, I may have been. I may have a steady paycheck if I had bombed that night.
There's that, too. So at the same time, I guess, you were also doing some things on the radio, and that's kind of how you got your start in the radio business. In fact, I guess you kind of made your solo radio debut in a trial by fire. You want to talk a little bit about the old Al Collins days?
Oh, gosh. How old was I? I was maybe 13 years old, 14 years old. I used to call Jazbo Collins on KGO. That's how far back I go with KGO. Anybody here remember Al Collins? Remember Jazbo? And he had this all-night show on Fridays and Saturday nights. And it's so funny because if you go to the Bay Area Museum of Broadcasting website, right. I went about 6 months ago, and they have one of his shows from 1977. And it's about nothing. I mean, the show was absolutely, people are calling up going, "Hey, Al, what's going on? I just want to tell you, I was looking outside and there was a leaf hanging out my window and it stood there and it blew in the wind for 2 minutes." And you say, "Wow, man, that's wild. That's wild, man." I mean, and that was Al's show. And so I would call up and talk about comic books. And so he would have me come on about every 3 or 4 months, and I'd have my little comic book price guide, and people would get the comics that they'd had in their attic and call me and call me and tell me what they were, and I'd look them up and tell them what they were worth. So one night I'm on the air doing this with him, and Al would have these coughing fits. He'd have these really, really big coughing fits. And being a young kid, what I didn't know was that during the breaks, he was going in the bathroom hitting a hash pipe. Al was an old beatnik. You know, he had the beret and the whole thing. And then he had to have been in his 60s or 70s or something.
Easily.
So we're on the air, and all of a sudden he starts coughing. And he turns the mic off and says, "Punch out some calls, kid," and leaves. leaves, walks out of the studio. I'm like 13 years old. And I turn and I look at the producer, and the producer just shrugs and goes like this. So I start going, "Hi, you're on KGO with Brian Copeland. Hi, you're on KGO." And that was the first time I ever hosted. So I have hashish to thank for my career in radio. Just say maybe, kids.
So from there, you get into stand-up, you're doing the...
My whole career is a fluke, I always say
TV
that.
Show.
My whole career is a fluke.
And then you become an author.
Yeah, well, actually, playwright first. Yeah,
playwright?
The play came first, and then the book based on the play. Not a Genuine Black Man. Well, you know that. You wrote about it. You reviewed it. and were very kind to me, which I appreciate.
It's a good show.
Thank you
and
very much.
And a good book, actually.
Thank you. Well, the way that whole thing came about, I'd been doing stand-up for, at this point, maybe 20 years, 18 years. And I had been doing, I've been traveling on the road opening for, like, Smokey Robinson and Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin and Natalie Cole and Dionne Warwick and these kinds of folks. And I'd come to this kind of career crossroads where I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do something different, but I didn't know what it was exactly I wanted to do. And I had gone through a divorce and got custody of my kids. And I always say that my ex and I had a custody fight. She won. I got the kids. So all of a sudden I'm home. I'm not traveling anymore. My whole life became about, you know, carpools and lunches and emergency forms. And, you know, I was ready to climb up on a tower with a rifle at that point. And I knew I wanted to do something, but I didn't know what to do. So this is in 2001. So 9/11 hits. And while there were a lot of really sad stories that came out of 9/11, the one that really got me was the story of Cantor Fitzgerald, the brokerage firm. And I don't remember which tower they were located in. But I'm watching CNN either that night or the night after, and they're interviewing the CEO of that company. And what the deal was that the CEO was usually the first person at his desk every single day. And this particular morning, September 11th, it's his son's first day of kindergarten, so he decides he's going to take his kid to school. So he wasn't there, but everybody else was. And he lost like 98 or 99% of his employees gone, wiped out. So I remember they went to a commercial break, and they show this montage of pictures of his employees, and they're all shapes and sizes and ages and colors. And I realized that these people got up that morning and they kissed their husbands and wives and boyfriends and girlfriends and said, "See you tonight. And, you know, someday I'm going to teach you how to fish, and someday we're going to go camping, and someday we're going to go to Europe, and someday. And then they went to work and they sat down in their cubicles and they were gone. And I started to cry and I realized, wow, you know, it's someday, because to be crass, you never know when your plane is going to hit your tower. So at that point, I decided I'm going to do everything that I've always said I'm going to do someday. And I took a yellow legal pad, and I started to make a list. At the top of it, I put someday. I called it my someday list, which later, now we call it a bucket list, which is funny because I ended up in that picture, which is just, again, my whole life's a fluke. And at the top of that list was to write a one-man stage play. I talked for years about I was going to do this, where it'd be a combination of comedy as well as drama and pathos. But I had no idea what to write about. So a couple weeks later, one of my comedy idols, Carl Reiner, was a guest on my KGO program. And during a break, I told Carl, I'm kind of at this crossroads, and I want to write something. I want to write a play, but I don't know what to write about. And Carl said, you know, every performer, every writer-performer comes to this crossroads. He says, for me, it was 1959. Sid Caesar's show had just been canceled. I've been with Sid for years and years, and now all of a sudden, what do I do? So somebody gave him a copy of Fred Allen, the great radio comedian, Fred Allen's book, Treadmill to Oblivion. Mm-hmm. And Fred Allen is one of my idols. Fred Allen is the one who said that television is called a medium because nothing is ever really well done. And, my favorite, a celebrity is someone who works hard all his life to be famous so he can wear dark glasses and hope not to be recognized. And what was the other one? We spend Monday to Saturday sowing our wild oats so that on Sunday we can go to church and pray for a crop failure. Love Fred Allen. My son Casey Allen is named after, his middle name is named after Fred Allen and Steve Allen, two of my heroes. Anyway, so in this book, in the preface of it, Fred, same thing, asked to write a book, didn't know what to write about, and got the advice, find the piece of ground that you alone stand on and nobody else does, and write from there. And his piece of ground was he had spent 18 years at NBC in network radio dealing with knuckleheads who didn't understand what it was that he was trying to do, you know, blue penciling and censoring, you know, his brilliant lines. He wrote the show himself. Him and he had one other writer, Herman Woke, started with him. Before he wrote The Caine Mutiny and other things, Herman Woke started out with Fred Allen. So this becomes Treadmill to Oblivion. So, you know, 6 or 7 years later, Carl is reading this book and starts thinking, okay, I need to write from the piece of ground that I alone stand on. What's that? And he thought, well, I'm a married comedy writer. I live in New Rochelle with my wife and kids, and I write for a comedy show in New York. And that idea became the Dick Van Dyke Show. So he said, you've got to find your piece of ground. And I go, I don't know what that is. And he said, well, that's what you got to figure out. So I took a couple of weeks off, and I come back into the station, and as I write in the play, they had all this mail piled up, and generally in talk radio, the only mail you get comes from old ladies and nuts. That's it. Nobody else writes. Old ladies and whack jobs. That's it.
Yes.
I got one guy in San Bernardino who's been writing me for years what I call ransom notes, because he cuts the letters out of papers and pastes, you suck, I hate you, all this stuff, and send it in. And I'm thinking, like, you know, where do I, like, drop the 20 grand to get my kid back? I'm looking for this. And then I came across one that was typed with an actual typewriter, which immediately caught my attention. I'm thinking, like, where do you find a ribbon for a typewriter, you know? Like, next to the buggy whips.
Yes.
And I open it up, and this unsigned letter says, as an African-American, I am disgusted every time I hear your voice because you are not a genuine black man. And I thought, no more calls. We have a winner. That's my piece of ground because, you know, from the time that I was a kid, I've been hearing this nonsense primarily from African-American people, but from white people too. Oh, you're not really black. You're black, but you're not really black. So I went through this whole self-inventory, again, that's in the book about, you know, what does that mean? You know, why did they say that? Because how I dress, how I talk, because I like to TiVo Frasier, you know?
Yeah.
I don't talk ghetto. You know, when I hear the word axe, I think of it as a noun. It's not a verb. I'm going to axe my mother. What are you, Lizzie Borden? Stop it. So I go through this whole thing, and I realize that because culturally, from the time that I was 8, my family moved from Hayward to San Leandro, which was 99.99% white, I spent most of my formative years as the only black face in the room. So I decided that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write a story about what it's like to be different, what it's like to be the only one, because at some point in your life, you're the only one. Whether the only black, the only white, the only Jew, the only Christian, whatever, you're going to be in a situation. And how do you navigate that minefield when you're the one who's different? So I'd walk my kids to school in the morning. And I would then go to this little cafe by my house, and I had number 2 natural wood pencils and marble composition notebooks, and I wrote down every story I could think of about what it was like to grow up and be different. And some were funny, and some were really painful, and I realized that there were a lot of things I'd repressed because they were so painful that it hurt to remember them. So this went on for about 9 or 10 months, and I had maybe about a dozen of these notebooks, front and back pages written. I thought, well, I've got enough raw material. Why don't I go down to the library and look at the microfilm and, you know, from newspapers from 1972, which is when we moved there, to find out what was going on in town at the time. So I go to the main San Leandro library, and I talk to the head librarian, Cindy Simmons, and I tell her I'm writing a one-man play about what it was like to grow up in San Leandro when there were not many black people there. And she goes, I got something that you need to see. So she goes in the back and she pulls out this stack of yellowing stack of typewritten papers. And what it was a term paper written by a San Leandro resident by the name of Don Magnifico for a sociology class at Cal State Hayward, then now Cal State East Bay, called How San Leandro's 10 Homeowners Associations Keep the City an All-White Ghetto. And I went, what? And I start to read this thing, and I find out that the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights had conducted hearings because they wanted to know why San Leandro was all white, but Oakland on the border was half black. They had subpoenaed everybody, you know, from city councilmen to the realtors to the lenders. I find out that Newsweek magazine had come to town because the mayor at the time was the mayor at the time was the national president of Democrats for Nixon. I'll wait again. Hashish plays a part in this story. And Newsweek was doing an article called Richard Nixon's Forgotten White Majority. And so they were going around the country doing snapshots where they would take a picture and then basically it was Archie Bunkers, you know, middle-aged white men who felt that the world was being taken over by the blacks and the Jews and the women and all the, and the hippies and so forth. And they came to San Leandro and they interviewed these three guys who know that they're clearly know their pictures are going to be there, and apparently by the way it's written they're being tape recorded because it's like a transcript, and they start popping off about how San Leandro needs a Hitler to take care of the troublemakers like Hitler did with the Jews in Germany. And so I realized at that point, wow, you know, this is not my story anymore. Now it's my story along with the story of an evolution of a city. And that's pretty much how that thing came to be. And so I then started to research what had gone on. And I found this dirty little history that nobody liked to talk about that apparently had gone on all across the country when you had a white flight to the suburbs and various schemes to keep people of color out. And that's where the story came from. Cool. That's the genesis.
Stop for just a second. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with radio talk show host, actor, comedian, and author, and playwright Brian Copeland. I'm Pat Craig. I don't know how many of you have seen Brian's show, but there's so much in that show. It's such an intense piece of work and fabulous show. If you haven't seen it, please see it. If you have seen it, see it again. And buy the book.
Thank you very much.
The thing, so many comics have done one-man shows, which sort of legitimizes stand-up.
You're right.
And all of that. And they get a franchise going, and the Caveman Show and all those other shows. But could you ever see anybody else doing the show that
you've
written? Never.
No, it's too personal. Because what it takes place in two time periods if you haven't seen it. And me being an eight-year-old boy moving into this hostile territory and all the stuff that's going on at the time and being harassed by the police and my mother having to fight eviction and being abused by my father. And then later on as an adult in 1999 when I went through a very, very severe bout of depression that was partially, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome that ended up with me one night in my car in the garage with the motor running and the door closed. And if a neighbor hadn't heard the music playing on the radio, I wouldn't be sitting here today. So it's funny, but it's heavy. What I did, interestingly, is I watched, when I was writing it, the rhythm I wanted was the rhythm that Norman Lear had. Because I grew up on all those great Norman Lear shows, you know, Maude and All in the Family, where it'd be really, really funny, and then Edith got raped. Remember that? And this is a sitcom. Or really funny on Good Times, and then JJ got shot by a gangbanger. Or really funny on Maude, and Maude got an abortion. I learned what menopause was watching Maude. And I said to my mother, Mommy, what's menopause? She goes, you'll get married. You'll find out. But I wanted that rhythm. And so that's kind of what it is. I'll get really, really heavy and dig a great big hole. And right before I get to China, I'll say something funny and pull you out of it. So there are a lot of different themes in it. From the outsider aspect, some people relate to the depression aspect. Some people relate to the housing discrimination aspect, to the racial identity aspect. Because as I've been called an Oreo, I find that that goes on in every culture. You know, you have Latinos who get grief from their fellow Latinos because they don't act Latino enough, whatever that means, and they call them coconuts. Brown on the outside, white on the inside. Asians will get the same thing from their Asian peers who don't feel that they are who feel that they're too Eurocentric, and they'll call them Twinkies, yellow on the outside, white on the inside. So this goes on in every single. Mike Wallace told me a story that he got grief every time he reported on the Middle East if he criticized Israel even a little bit. And it was, you know, he would report impartially. He would get all of these letters from people saying that you're not a real Jew, because no genuine Jew would ever criticize Israel under any circumstances. So you have the ethnicity police in every race and culture. And so that's another aspect of it. So from the play, I was asked to write a book, and which is great, was because once the play opened, then all these people start coming to me with stories, and I'm thinking, well, I'm done now. And I had a place to put all this other information. And what's great is that the book is required reading, and a number of colleges, universities, high schools are requiring it. I got a call a month ago from President Obama's Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, John Trasvina. And he wants me to take the book and the play to use across the country to educate people on housing discrimination, because it still goes on. Wow. So, I mean, this was supposed to be a 6-week play, then I'd be done and on to something else. And here I am.
It certainly is all that. Let's take a few questions from the audience. I know that your play went to Broadway. How long was it on Broadway, and what was that like?
Actually, it was off Broadway. We were off Broadway, and I ran for 100 performances. We did did 3 months, and it was very, very hard. It was hard for two reasons. I had a great director. My original director and collaborator, David Ford, did the version that you've all seen here and the version that I am still performing. Bob Balaban, who's a wonderful actor and director, who did The Exonerated, directed me in New York. And we moved some things around and cut some things, and I wasn't really thrilled with, but it wasn't, you know, when you're dealing with a producer who was there $100,000, you got to do with their money. The biggest problem I had, though, with New York, it was fun, but the problem that I had was I had to do 8 shows a week. And I do 30 characters. It's 2 hours. I have to go to those dark places of being in the garage, and I have to go to those dark places of being 8 years old and frisked by the police and the depression and all that stuff. And my mother being beaten by my father and watching it. And I can't, you know, I can't beat my mother twice on Saturday and twice on Sundays. I just can't do it. And so after a while, it started to eat at my soul. Imagine. And that was the hardest part of it. I can't do the show more than 3 or 4 times a week. I just can't.
Yeah.
But other than that, it really was a great experience.
Where did you move to San Leandro from, and how was your life before you moved to San Leandro, from what you can remember, different in terms of race?
I was born in Akron, Ohio, and we didn't know really any white people, I'm trying to think. I don't believe. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when I was colored when I was born. I was colored when I was born, and then I became Negro. Then I became Black, and now African American. And I'm just waiting to see what I'll be next. Then we moved. My father was stationed at Fort Hood, and so we moved to Killeen, Texas, and then we lived around all Latinos. Then I went to kindergarten there, and then we moved to California and lived in Hayward, and then from Hayward to San Leandro. And Hayward, even then, was actually fairly diverse. So I had never had any real experiences with actual racism, although I got grief from Black people who would say that because I spoke proper English. You know, my mother was very, very prim and proper. At my house, if I said ain't, I may as well have said the F word. That's how my mother was. Now, my mother and my grandmother raised me. And my grandma, on the other hand, was, you know, grandma was, you know, born and raised in Jim Crow, Alabama, before she moved to Akron, and she just called it. My mother was put on airs, very pretend. My mother was born in Alabama, but would tell people she was from Providence, Rhode Island, because it sounded better. And grandma just lived to, like, you know, pop her balloon when she would get too big for her break. I'll tell you two stories that illustrate grandma's character. First one, I'm in high school. I think it was junior year. And the yearbook came out, and it was a terrible picture of me in the yearbook that year. And I come home to grandma, I go, grandma, look at this picture in the yearbook of me. It's awful. It's terrible. It's horrible. Skinny Rob forever. It's awful. And she said, well, the camera can't take nothing but what's in front of it. What'd you expect the camera to do? Thank you for your loving support. Second story, my favorite story. My favorite story about grandma. Grandma was a very, very big fan of Jack Parr. And this is, again, before my time. Jack Parr was when he hosted The Tonight Show, Grandma loved him. And
he replaced Al Collins on The Tonight Show, actually.
That's right. Al Collins did fill in for a month between Steve Allen and – no, between Jack Parr and Carson.
Yeah.
They did a couple of tryouts. Don Sherwood, I think, tried out as well, too.
Yeah.
So Grandma loved Jack Parr. So 62, Carson takes over. This is before I was born, so this was family lore. And Carson's first night hosting The Tonight Show, Grandma sits down and says, I got to see this because I don't believe he going to make it. So for years, we tease her about this, right? October 1992, after 30 years, Carson hangs it up. Grandma stood in front of the TV and went, see?
Brian, I've been following you in the Bay Area since the 80s, newcomer. Glad to see your successful evolution. What has been the most unusual change in San Leandro you have observed since you grew up in San Leandro?
Well, when we moved there, according to the 1960 census, it was 99.99% white. According to the 1970 census, 99.99% white. As of the 2000 census, it is the fourth most neighborhood diverse city in the state of California.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. In the state of California. And part of the reason, though, too, other right, is there's been kind of a white flight from there. The kids I grew up with, their parents had grown up in Oakland, and then after the war, when there was blockbusting going on and there was a white flight to San Leandro, the kids I grew up with have run to, you know, Alamo and Danville and San Ramon and all the places that are now overwhelmingly white. I always say it's my goal to drive them into the sea. But I still live there. It's a great place. It is a great place to live. And it's a very, very diverse and people of all different cultures.
That's something I'm curious about, that you have lived there.
Mm-hmm.
You've remained
37
there
years I've been there.
Yeah. And it's just like, wow. Is it that the city has evolved so much that you can feel comfortable there?
It's that the city's evolved so much and that my mother fought too damn hard for us to be there. Mm. You know, and, you know, I lost her when I was 14 years old. I lost my mother when I was 14 years old, and part of it was, you know, being stubborn like she was. You know, and I'd rather Sam from San Leandro than Rhode Island because nobody's going to buy that.
Okay. Given you're not a black man, genuine black man. What do you think about Harry Reid's comments about Obama that has created such a stir?
I think it's ridiculous for several reasons. Number one, the word Negro is not, in my opinion, offensive or a slur. It's antiquated. It's an old term, but Martin Luther King constantly used the word to refer to people of color. He did not mean it in a derogatory way. He was one of, if not the biggest supporter in the Senate of Barack Obama to run for the presidency. This was a comment that was made in private to two reporters that should have been off the record, I would have assumed, but ended up instead in this book, and people are taking it the wrong way. If you haven't heard the comments, they've been everywhere today, that he said that he was a light-skinned. He had a chance of being. It was more electable because he's a light-skinned Negro. He's light-skinned and doesn't use Negro dialect unless he chooses to.
Yeah.
Well, it's true. It's true. I'm serious. There are several studies that have shown that whenever if there's a black candidate and a white candidate, white voters will more often gravitate towards the white candidate. If you're a lighter skinned African American and a darker skinned, the lighter skinned will get more votes. And that is, there's several studies. And in terms of the dialect thing, I mean, it's, as I said, the King's English, Ebonics is a laughing stock, ridiculous concept, but linguists use the phrase black dialect to, you know, describe what I just call bad grammar. And I'm sorry, if you say I'm going to ax my mother, it sounds ignorant, you know, and if you don't know the proper use of the verb to be, you're not going to get a job in broadcasting or representing someone's company sitting at the reception desk. So what is wrong, other than the fact that he used an antiquated term? I don't think that he did anything that's wrong. Mm.
How much longer do you plan on doing your play?
I don't know. I'm not done yet. I've just done my 605th performance of the show. And I go to Los Angeles tomorrow, and then we go to Seattle, and we're working on actually a national tour. So I'm going to do it for a while. I'm not finished.
Looks like we're almost finished. But we have a few more questions. How long did it take you to write your play? What prompted you to write a play first rather than a book?
Okay, well, again, it was number one on my someday list, and that's what prompted me to write it. And I told you how the whole process took me maybe 3 years from conception to getting it on the stage. Excuse me. About 3 years, the entire process. And the way the book came about, again, the whole thing's a fluke. You know, when the reviews came out, it was supposed to be 6 weeks, and then I go on to the next thing on my list. So the reviews came out, and the critics, starting with you, were very, very kind. And I get a call out of the blue from Amy Rennert, who had been a producer on my very first TV show on Channel 9 back in the day. And she said, I read the review of your play, and, you know, I'm now a literary agent in Marin, and I think that your play would be a good book. You ever think about writing a book? And coincidentally, writing a book was number two on my Sunday list. I'm serious. So she helped me put together a book proposal, and it sold in 3 days. There was a bidding war, and it sold in 3 days. And what I found out afterwards was, among the editors who were bidding for it, one was a Jewish gentleman who said, we were the first Jews in our neighborhood in the suburbs of Kansas City around that time. This is my story. Another was an Asian woman. We were the first Asians in the suburbs of Philadelphia. This is my story. You know, we were the other only Latinos in the suburbs of Seattle in our neighborhood. This is my story. And again, that outsider thing, it just clicked with a lot of people, a lot of different ways.
Did you have any clue then when you were performing at the Marsh and all of that it would be as big as it is?
No idea. Again, it was supposed to be 6 weeks, and then I would be done. And I think the first night there were 7 people there. The second night there were 14 people. The third night there were like 40. And then the reviews came out, and then you couldn't get in the place for the next 2.5 years. Yeah. It became the longest-running one-man show in the history of Bay Area theater. I had no idea. It was supposed to be 6 weeks, and then I would be finished. But the thing that really kicked it off, too, is that educators started to require their classes, college classes, in sociology, psychology, childhood development, California history, to come and to see the show and to write papers on it. And so that's been a really big part of the audience. In fact, if you go to Google and you Google Not a Genuine Black Man and hit blogs, you can see there's a class in religious diversity at Cal State Long Beach that requires the book, and their midterms are posted online. And so there's questions about my life in I'm college credit, which is the most bizarre.
How many units are you, Brian? when did you realize that this was a huge hit and would be a major chunk of your life?
I'll tell you when I realized it was a hit. I have been with the William Morris Agency for a long, long, long time. And if when you're with a big agency like that, it can sometimes take you weeks or months to get your agent on the phone. And one day my phone rings and I answer it, and it was my agent calling me. And that's how I knew that I had a hit.
That's great. Okay, this is a good follow-up question. I missed your play. When can I see it again?
Well, let's see. We go to L.A. tomorrow. Next time I'm here in the Bay Area, I'm doing a benefit, actually, at my alma mater, at Moreau Catholic High School in Hayward on February the 27th for the theater program. So you can get tickets there. Also, if you go to briancopeland.com, you can always see where the play is going to be performed. We've always got a calendar there and tickets and updates. Information as well. Also there, if you go to the e-press kit area, there is a great documentary that Westinghouse CBS did on San Leandro at that time. It aired in 1971, called The Suburban Wall.
Yes.
And I found the only surviving copy of it, and you can watch it on the site. So just go, it'll blow your mind. The things these people say, it's like something out of the Deep South. It will blow your mind.
That is an incredible thing. That's certainly worth seeing. Do you have plans to write or perform any more plays? Is that number three on the list?
What's going on right now is we're trying to develop Genuine as a television series. We're working on that right now. I'm working on the second book, which is it's called Grandma and Me. And it's a book about grandma raising us by herself after my mother passed away, and in juxtaposed with me being a single parent, you know, 20 years later. Yeah. And I'm hoping to have it out like Mother's Day of next year is the plan. It's called Grandma and Me, an Ode to Single Parents.
Sounds good. What did you want to accomplish with your play? And then how much has San Leandro changed? Describe a little bit about the city's racial transformation.
Well, in terms of accomplish anything, people always ask me that. What was your message? And I was just telling a story. That's it. I had no agenda. I was just telling a story. That was it. And you know, people have taken so many different things from it. I'll tell you the most surprising thing. Somebody asked me about New York earlier. After the show, generally, I like to come out and shake hands with people, and I'll say shake hands and thank them for coming. And when I was in New York, there were a lot of folks that would come out and shake my hand and say, oh, I enjoyed your show very much, and by the way, you know, I was at Auschwitz, or I was at Bergen-Belsen, or I was... And so all these survivors were coming to the show. So one day I asked a gentleman, I said, why are so many survivors coming to the show? What are they getting from this? And he said... Survivors walk around in the world full of people. They could be on Madison Avenue at noontime on a Friday when there are a million people on the street, yet they'll feel like they're in a bubble all alone because you can't get it because you weren't there. And there's something about this isolated little boy who can't find any safe haven at home, you know, where his father beats him, who can't find a safe haven at school, where the nuns even beat him up, who can't find a safe haven walking down the street to play baseball because the police stop him and say that his bat is a weapon and it's a felony. And that they relate to that aspect of it. And that was really surprising. The other thing is people take a lot about depression, because I am very honest about my depression in the play and in the book. And the most fascinating thing that happened to me in regard to that, because that whole garage thing was very, I really struggled about whether or not to put that in. Because, it, you know, it was such a stigma. It's like you have a scarlet D when you talk about depression. And I really struggled with it. And I still, even after reviews came out and people were coming and filling up the theater, I wasn't sure it was the right decision. Until one night, it's a Saturday, I'll never forget this, it's a Saturday, and I'm shaking hands with the audience as they leave. And usually folks will come up to tell me, you know, when we lived, you know, in Philadelphia, this is what happened to us and this. And they'll tell me how they grew up and tell me their stories. And there was this very attractive woman dressed in a, you know, a business suit. She looked like she just maybe came from her law office to the show. And she's at the end of the line, and I thought she was going to tell me one of these stories. And instead she said, I think about killing myself every single day. And I never told a living soul because I was afraid that they would lock me up. But I figure if you can get up here every night and tell strangers, on Monday I can go get some help.
Wow.
And I went, I still kind of get goosebumps when I think about that. And I went, wow, okay, I guess it was the right decision. It was the right decision to make. And so I do a lot of speeches. I talk to school kids a lot, to teenagers, and I tell them, you know, because my depression really manifested itself when I was a teenager. That when it was when it really started to kick in. And, you know, there are so many people that suffer in silence. I can guarantee you in this room, there are 20% of you who are on something or should be, you know. but, you know, it's a disease that you have no more control over than if you had, you know, leukemia or Lou Gehrig's disease or anything else. But it can be managed, but it's not something to be ashamed of.
Can you talk about how your sense of humor jibes with the horrible things that happened to you when you were a kid and the notion of depression?
Well,
a way out?
I can tell you that, yeah. Well, it was two things. I used to get beaten up every day. Every day the kids would beat me up. Because I couldn't fight. I wasn't a fighter. But I realized that if I could make them laugh, they would forget that they wanted to beat me up. And I talk my way out of a lot of butt whoopings by joking around. And there's also the adage that's the truth. Comics, most comics you will find came from really messed up childhoods. And we laugh so we don't cry. And the only two I can think of I've ever read who grew up and were really well-adjusted were Jack Benny was apparently very well-adjusted growing up, and Jay Leno, his family was very normal and well-adjusted, and who would have thought he would have ended up doing this. But most you look at most others, you'll find horrific. You know, Jim Carrey, like, lived in a car with his family was so poor, they lived in a car, you know, at one point, were homeless. And just, you know, you hear these horrible, horrible stories. And that's how we get through the day. That's how we get through the day.
So it was a way of defending yourself at first.
Defense and self-medication at the same time. Self-medicating at the same time.
That's great. Now, do you receive much criticism from whom, and how do you handle it?
Who the hell wrote that? I'm kidding. I mean, you can't be in the public eye and not get criticism. I mean, I wrote a book and I put it out there. And, you know, I'm fortunate that it's been very well received. And, you know, it's like 5 stars on Amazon and those people like it. But every once in a while, I'll get a letter from somebody or an email, you know, from somebody that's, you know, nasty, that they missed the whole point and they didn't get it. And, you know, I'll tell you what I generally do. If I get a nasty email from somebody, I will write back. You really need to contact your server because somebody has gotten your password and is writing nasty things under your login. That's how I handle it.
That's great. That's probably the best way to handle the things, you know, having gotten my share of nasty notes.
Well, I heard Art Hoppe. I had Leah Garchick on my program yesterday. Leah Garchick from the San Francisco Chronicle, and Art Hoppe, he used to wrote for them for years. She started out as a secretary for him. And what he used to do when he'd get a nasty letter is he would write back, "Your cookbook will be sent under separate cover." Isn't that great?
That's wonderful. Have to read this. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with radio talk show host, actor, comedian, author, and playwright Brian Copeland. I'm Pat Craig. So,
your mileage may vary.
How old are your children, and what are they doing now?
They are 20, 18, and 14. I have a junior in college. My son Adam, who wants to be, is studying to be a broadcast journalist. He wants to be a sportscaster. And my daughter Carolyn, who's a freshman, who's a journalism major. And my son Casey, who is at Moreau, is a freshman at my alma mater.
Huh?
So they all, yeah, all three of them came through my alma mater. So that's what they're doing, that and driving me crazy. Well, we had this whole conversation before we got on the air. I did a thing with Bill Cosby the other night at the Flint Center. And because I've just, what drives me crazy is, you know, if you pay for college, you know, if you have kids in college, you've been through this. You pay for college as the parents, but you can't get the grades because they're adults. They're adults and they're entitled to their privacy, but you are paying the bill. So I told Cosby this, and he, you know, did this wonderful, wonderful routine about all of the grief he went through getting his daughter from grade school, I mean from high school, all the way through college. And it was just brilliant. He said, the best line is, he says that colleges do not raise children. Colleges raise prices.
I know those colleges. two kids in college, one in high school.
Two in college, one in high school.
Oh, so you will have to go on the road quite a bit.
Oh, you better believe it.
How much time with the show are you out now? Are you?
It's sporadic. I mean, I've been, you know, camped here in the Bay Area for quite a bit, but yeah, I'm taking it other places. The longest run I've had out of town was when I went to New York. We ran in Los Angeles, but I just, you know, did, when I do LA, I'll do weekends, a couple of shows a week. With this national tour and the stuff that we do for HUD, which is still, we're not sure how that's going to work yet. I can't be gone for long periods of time because of the kids. You know, I'll go out and do a couple of nights a month here or there.
Anything new on the TV series? How do you imagine that being done?
Well, see, that's the hard part is we're not sure. I've got Courtney Conti, who was the president of Carsey Warner during The Cosby Show and mm-hmm. Grace Under Fire and Roseanne Years, is attached as the executive producer, but we don't have a deal set up with the network yet because we're having trouble with the format, and that's the problem. You know, how do you, you know, take this premise and put it into a format that's a sustaining series? So I've been through like 25 or 30 different drafts of various ideas. I think we've got it now. I think we know what we're going to do now. And good. I don't want to talk about it because I'll jinx it.
Well, yeah, yeah. But I mean, I'm just thinking about it. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine mm-hmm. how that can translate into a series.
Yeah, oh, we tried it every which way, from the kid's point of view, from my point of view as an adult, you know, jumping back and forth in time, period. We've tried every which way, and we just couldn't get the tone. We tried a half an hour, we tried it as an hour, and it's just getting the tone right, because yeah. the tone of the play and the book are very, very unique.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Let's see. San Leandro had for many years Portuguese as maybe the largest population segment. Do you think that had anything to do with the overt discrimination?
No, I don't think so. I think it was more a remnant of, I guess, fear. I think it was more because people were just afraid of those who were different. You know, this whole concept of blockbusting, which I'd never heard of before until I started to research this. If you're not familiar with the practice, way work was like this. They did this in Oakland. They would, realtors would come into a neighborhood that was all white. And then they would offer a homeowner maybe twice what his home was worth. And he'd jump at it, you know, thinking he won the lottery and take off. Then the realtor would sell the home at a loss or rent it to the first black family he could find. And within a week, every house on the street would be for sale. And he would then scoop them up at a discount and sell them to black families and make a bundle. And what would happen is then, you know, that's where white flight came in, and they would run to other areas that had various schemes in place. In San Leandro, it was homeowners associations that could arbitrarily decide who was and who was not a fit resident to buy in that city. And the associations had the realtors on board, because if you go to briancopeland.com, watch the Suburban Wall, you'll see realtors interviewed in 70, 71 about this. The realtors are on board, and they have to be if they want to do business in that town. At the time, the city council, each association had one city councilman representing the association. So if you were a renter, automatically you were disenfranchised, so they controlled the city council. And the police used to sit at the border of Oakland and San Leandro. They called it the Invisible Wall on East 14th Street. And there was a cop whose job it was to follow any black pedestrian, motorist, or cyclist who crossed over into the city limits, even kids. I've met guys my age who talk about being 8, 9, 10 years old and riding their bikes across the city limits. And there's a cop pacing him until either he found a pretext to stop them or they were so intimidated they turned around and went back across the border.
Wow.
So that, it was just, you know, fear of being different. You know, here it was illegal, you know, to discriminate, but they tried to find ways around it.
So how did the homeowners associations keep one person from buying and another from would be allowed to buy?
As I said, they had the realtors on board, and so the realtors would not show
homes.
So
they just simply not.
They just simply wouldn't show homes. Oh, well, there's one story I tell in the book about there was a family who listed with a black real estate broker, and everybody in the neighborhood found out, and so they called their city councilman. No, they called the president of the homeowners association, who called their city councilman, who called a white broker he knew, who called the black broker and got the black broker to agree not to show the home to blacks. I mean, that's how insidious this thing was. That's how this whole thing worked. So, but there, it was illegal to discriminate. Well, again, one of the things too, you know, there's a lot in the news today about Proposition 8 and about gay marriage and, you know, why is this even going to court? Because the people voted for it and that's it. And what people forget is that something else I found out in research is that in 1964, I believe it was, 1963, the California State Legislature passed the Rumford Fair Housing Act,
right,
okay, which said that you could not discriminate in housing on the basis of race, creed, religion, color, any of that stuff. So the realtors put a proposition on the ballot, Proposition 14. And what Prop 14 said was, yes, you can. And it passed in every single city in California except for Berkeley, where Byron Rumford, who wrote it, was from. And so it went to the California State Supreme Court and then ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court, who threw it out and said, you know, no, it's a violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, among other things. And you cannot give people rights or take away people's rights by referendum. You know, that is tyranny of the majority. You cannot vote and decide because we're the majority. These are the rights you can have and these are the rights you cannot have. So, but this was just widespread. There were realtors. I found quotes from realtors saying, if I've got to show homes to blacks, then I'll get out of the business. I found somebody gave me a magazine, I think the Saturday Evening Post from 1959. And it's got like a Norman Rockwell picture on the front. And it's all white kids with one little black girl sitting in the middle. And the headline is Neighborhood Panic, What to Do When a Negro Moves to Town. Or when a Negro moves on the block. So I read the story, and what the story is about is this white family that's trying to stop white flight and blockbusting in Baltimore. And all of the things that they're trying to show, you know, in terms of, you know, they are black professionals who are trying to move into the area, lawyers and doctors, and like, you have nothing to be afraid of. And they don't want to see the city, you know, turn into what, you know, now 50 years later, the city of Baltimore has apparently turned into, if you watch The Wire. So I guess they lost. But it's just amazing. People fear that which they don't know. They fear that which is different and that which they don't understand.
And I think the thing that sort of strikes me about this, too, is, you know, we're sitting at home in the 60s and 70s watching all these horrible people in the South doing all of these horrible things, when just down the street, something that's maybe even a little more insidious is happening.
Well, that's the thing, too, about this. The thing that makes this a story is that it takes place in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
If this story took place in Mississippi, people would go, and your point is what?
That's true.
Oh, if this were Alabama and your point, and? Yeah. But the fact is, you know, on this Harry Reid thing, for example, what's funny is, you know, we talk about, you know, racism in America and whether or not it's worse in the South as opposed to the West or the North or the East. And what I have found is it's not any different. The only difference is, at least in the South, they'll say it to your face, whereas in other places, they'll wait till you leave the room. That's the difference.
Wow.
That is the difference.
Do schools invite you to come speak to the students? By the way, I'm from Providence, Rhode Island.
Schools invite me, and I've got to go to Providence. I do. I want to go one time because it's my adopted hometown, I guess.
Definitely. Definitely need to move in there. Oh, this is blank. You know, maybe we have a little time left, but it...
Actually, it made me think about it. Something people always ask me is if I think things are different since Barack Obama has been elected, or how the Obama election has affected me or my perspective. And I'll tell you a very funny story. Election night, I'm home watching the returns with... My daughter Carolyn worked at the polls. She's 17 years old. She wanted to vote, but she worked at the polls and registered and you know, helped people to vote. So my son Adam and I had gone down. It was the neatest thing. Adam and I had gone down. It was his first election, and Carolyn signed us in. And I brought Casey, you know, because I always brought the kids since they were in strollers to with me when I voted, because I thought it was important that they saw this and it looked like something that you normally did. And so Carolyn signs us in, and we vote, and, you know, we go home. And I went out to pick up some food. Somebody called me on the radio, some racist that called me on the radio the Sunday before, going, oh, you're going to love it when Obama wins, because you can go out now and you can have all, I'll bet you, celebrate with fried chicken. And I said, that's a great idea. So I dropped the kids off at home, and I went to get I got fried chicken, I got malt liquor, I got fried pork rinds. And And I'm on my way to pick this stuff up, and I get a phone call from – I get a phone call as I'm on my way to Kentucky Fried Chicken. I get a phone call from a colleague of mine who says, did you see the story in the AP out of Alabama over the weekend? And I go, well, no, which one? He goes, well, there was somebody canvassing and a pollster knocking on doors in rural Alabama asking who they were going to vote for. And they, one of the pollsters goes to this, you know, kind of broken down shack and knocks on the door, and this white woman, and, you know, Alabama white woman answers the door, and he says, yes, ma'am, I'm taking a poll. We'd like to know who it is you're going to vote for, if you know you're going to vote for Tuesday. And she yells back, you know, in the house, hey, honey, who are you going to vote for? And a man's voice says, tell me we're going to vote for the nigger. And I thought, wow, the Republicans lost the racists. Bush has even lost the race. Maybe he can pull this off. So 801, that's a true story. I'm not making this up. So 801, Pacific Standard Time, when he is declared the president-elect, all of a sudden, my house phone, my landline starts to ring off the hook. My cell phone rings. Adam's cell phone's ringing. Every white person we know is going, congratulations! I'm really happy for you guys. Good job, you guys. And I'm going, I checked the box. He's not the president of black people. He's the president of the United States. Congratulations. I actually worked for Bill Clinton the first time, and nobody called me and said congratulations. Good job, you guys. I'm really happy for you. Now, let me go. I'm eating chicken.
So did you get the chicken? And
oh, yeah.
Okay.
I thought, what a great idea. Orange soda was wonderful.
Let's see. Would you consider speaking at a junior high in the Richmond School District in West Contra Costa County?
Yeah, I would consider it. Sure. I would consider speaking any place that I'm asked, just depending upon my schedule. Sure. Certainly.
Okay. And we're getting kind of short on time, and I thought it might be good to just open up to the audience if you have any questions. We just have a couple of minutes. So anybody want to? Yes, sir.
No, I didn't go to high school. And the question is, what high school did I go to in San Leandro? I didn't. I went to Catholic school. I went to a Moreau Catholic in Hayward is where I went. And I'll tell you another funny story. Now, in that class, I was class of 82, and I was the only black in a class of 350. I went to my high school class reunion, my 20th reunion, and I walked in the door, and they gave me a name tag. I go, you got to be kidding me.
Did you put doctor in front of
you? Prodigy doctor.
So, okay. All right. We just, I understand for the radio we can't take questions from the audience. So if you want to really quickly write something out, that would be just great. So raise your hand if you need to have a question answered. And since I'm on a mic, maybe I can ask you another question.
Mm-hmm.
All of that.
Anything you want to know. I just realized my kids are here. I should not have told that fake ID story. I have two of my underage kids here, and I'm thinking, what the hell am I doing?
No, I want you to talk a little bit about your writing process. You touched on it, but I mean the importance of those notebooks and sitting in the coffee shop.
Well, it's 90% butt in seat. Is really what it is. The process at the beginning was just, Steve Allen was one of my heroes, and I had the opportunity to work with him, and he was very nice in that he mentored me in a lot of different ways. And Steve published in his lifetime 52 books and left another 53 in various stages of completion. And what he did was he dictated everything, because what he said is the first draft is it's all where all the creativity is anyway. And so you just go, you don't censor yourself, you just write. Mm-hmm. And then you come back and you fix it. And when I was writing Genuine, I took the mindset that nobody's ever going to see this. And that way I wouldn't self-censor, because I knew that I had to be naked in order for this to work. I had to tell the truth and I had to be naked. So I said, nobody will ever see this. And I wrote that way. Then when I got the book contract, when I accepted the advance, I knew that, you know, I had to have button seat and had to have, you know, certain pages in when they needed pages in. So what I would do is I would periodically, I would price line a hotel. And find a hotel somewhere. I went to Brisbane. I went to just places around, you know, Vallejo. And I would lock myself in for a week and find reasons not to write until I got my words done. And then I would let myself out. But, that's kind of how that process worked. One of the things I did when I was procrastinating, Jonathan Kellerman is one of my favorite authors, and I learned how to do the voices for Genuine listening to his audiobooks, the Alex Delaware books. Any fans of Jonathan Kellerman? Yeah, one of the top-selling authors in America. And so one day I'm in this hotel looking for reasons not to write, and I'm procrastinating, and I think, I wonder if Jonathan Kellerman has a website. So I go to his website and I find it and I hit contact and I send him an email. Hi, my name is Brian. And, you know, I have this book and this play and da, 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 and I'm a writer and you're a writer. Let's be friends. And he writes me back within an hour. And he kind of led me through this thing.
Got to sign out for just our thanks to Brian Copeland, radio talk show host, actor, comedian, author, and playwright of Not a Genuine Black Man. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. I'm Pat Craig, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
We're off the air, so can I cuss now?
You can cuss now.
I can cuss now? No, I'm kidding.
There's one question. I really want to hear the answer to this.
Oh, before you leave, folks, I want to mention, too, that I'll be doing a book signing. If you have not picked up Genuine or if you have a copy you brought with you, as soon as we get done here, you can go and say hi to my daughter and my son. They're manning the table for me tonight. So I'll be happy to sign your books.
What else is on your someday list?
I want to learn how to tie a real bow tie. And I'll tell you something that's funny. I bought one for New Year's Eve, you know, to wear with a tuxedo. And at the tuxedo store, the guy didn't know. I have not been able to find anyone who knows how to tie a real bow tie. You know how to do it?
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
No.
You're the first person I found who knows how to do that. It's a dying art.
It's a useless skill. It's what it is. But you're right.
I want to learn how to do it.
There's something
you know why?
To knowing that.
You know why I want to learn how to do it? Because I like that look. I love Sinatra. And I like
yes.
that look of when you untie it and it's hanging loose. So what I did on New Year's Eve is I walked around with just a tie around my neck hanging loose.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much for coming.